For me, it would have just been a light bulb, even just to see one LGBT family and to know that this was something that was real and this was happening. It was just something that wasn't being talked about. But the invalidation that those families are facing is heartbreaking to me because it doesn't have to be this way. Everyone's families can be recognized as valid. We don't have to demonize certain kinds of families.
Back in the 1980s, when young Abby Goldberg's divorced mom struck up a romantic relationship with a woman, Abby didn't have any models to look to, no vocabulary to help her understand or feel understood in this queer configuration. Today, Abby's a clinical psychologist and an internationally recognized scholar of LGBTQ families. She's become an expert on queer families, especially the practical and legal obstacles they face, as well as the strengths they bring to the entire family-making enterprise. Abby E. Goldberg joins us to talk about her new book, LGBTQ Family Building, A Guide for Prospective Parents. There's many ways to be a family, and every kind of family has something that we can learn from. I'm Blair Hodges, and this is Family Proclamations. Abby E. Goldberg joins us today on Family Proclamations. Abby, it's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've done decades of research. You've written a lot of journal articles, a lot of books, and academic work about LGBTQ families. What inspired you to write about this topic and to research this as your career?
Well, you know, if I'm going to go really way back, I was raised in a queer parent family myself in the 80s, mostly in the suburbs of New York. And I did not see my family represented in most media depictions of families and most of what we were reading about in families in school. And so I grew up kind of thinking a lot about what families are visible and what families are invisible. And so I was always really passionate about trying to understand and kind of make visible different kinds of families.
Wow. So, I mean, that was well before, obviously, the legalization of same-sex marriage. And what was that like for you? Were you an only child, siblings? What was the family like?
Yeah. So I had two brothers, one much older than me and one younger. And so we experienced our heterosexual parents' relationship dissolution at different times in our life. So it shaped us, I think, in different ways. Our family was really, you know, from the outside, I think looked pretty typical, like a divorced family. But, you know, on the inside, my mother was partnered with a woman. And so that was really not something that most people knew. And it was really only something that we started talking about, you know, when I probably went to college, maybe late in high school. So a few people knew, but it was mostly a secret.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I thought a lot about that over the last couple of decades about how keeping those kinds of secrets, when actually there's really nothing wrong with your family as it is, it's just that it's just not accepted in the broader society, how that can shape kids. So,
wow, that makes me think of two things. One, the fact that we've seen a sea change here in your own lifetime. You're part of a big change in visibility for families. And also the fact that families like this have always existed in some way, or that people have always been experiencing feelings and love and trying to make that work in a society that hasn't always been accepting. So the work that you're doing for prospective parents in this book is really valuable. In a way, your own family was pioneering things, and now you as a scholar are a pioneer in helping move that along. So I didn't know that about you before I set up the interview. That's really fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah. Oprah Daily did an interesting piece kind of profiling my work and how my personal life influenced me and a little bit about my trajectory. So it's a fun piece. It's done by a wonderful New York Times reporter that I have worked with over the years and who I trusted enough to tell my story. So it gives a little bit more detail.
Say a little bit more about that trusted enough, because obviously this is a really personal thing. So when you're thinking about being public about it, what was that like for you then?
Yeah. So when I was, you know, earlier in my career, I was advised by some folks not to really talk about my own personal experience and how it shaped my interests and my trajectory. And I think that's complicated advice, right? I'm not going to say it's bad advice. I think what people were concerned about is that so many of the high profile researchers studying LGBT families were gay themselves. And there was some concern that their work was invalidated because of that. And so here comes this nice cisgender straight woman, you know, by all intents and purposes, that's the way that I am perceived.
Yeah.
And so I can sort of elevate my work in a different way and maybe be taken seriously and get the work taken seriously in a different way. So I think there was that, a little bit of that kind of excitement. On the other hand, I think the personal is important. And I think that I'm at a stage in my career where I don't really have concerns about sharing my story in the way that it could affect my access to certain opportunities, for example.
Right. That's really interesting that you got that kind of advice. And we've seen a shift where people are a bit more confessional now in the academy. Scholars might be more willing to talk about where they're coming from, about their background, but there's still, it's a really interesting taboo, I think, that still exists. And there is that fear that it could call into question people's research or something. So, but on the other hand, I think knowing a little bit about your background does help because of who you are as a person as well. There have always been questions about whether, you know, non-heteronormative families could raise successful children or what those families would look like. And so not only are you doing research, in some ways you yourself complicate any kind of stereotypes that way. So thanks for sharing that. I'll make sure to link to that in the show notes so people can check that out. So this book is set apart from your other work because it's written for a more broad audience. Doing academic research, you know, an article might reach dozens,
right? If we're lucky.
Yeah, after so much work. And so you've turned to write for a broader audience for this. Talk about that decision a little bit and how that's been for you.
Yeah, so my work has straddled both kind of the traditional academic audience and the more kind of popular press over the last 10 years. But definitely I've been kind of increasingly moving towards a more mainstream audience. So I wrote a book in 2012 called Gay Dads, but it was with an academic press. And a lot of, you know, lay people seem to have read it because I do get, you know, still get emails about it. Mm. But it was more of a story about how do gay dads become dads. And this is really taking all the things that I have learned in the last 20 years and saying, here's some information that I hope will be helpful to you. So there are stories in it. There are vignettes. There are really some wonderful, there's a lot of data, you know, for people who want that. But there's a lot of guidance and exercises and thought questions and really trying to make this information interesting and usable for a wider range of folks.
The questions that you include are so helpful. So to let people know, throughout the chapters, there are different places where it'll just have a series of questions you can ask yourself or you can talk to a partner about things like whether you want to have kids or what, you know, just a lot of different things. The kind of questions that it's really helpful to have someone who spent so much time in this space give some ideas for people to discuss. So to me, one of my favorite parts of the book were those question sections because I'm cishet, like I have a partner and two kids. Very, we look very traditional, quote unquote. And even for me, a lot of those questions were really useful. So
yeah, I think a lot of the questions are great for anybody to ask themselves. I mean, I think
we
really need to start thinking about parenthood as, I hope, it's something that people really think through before they endeavor to kind of pursue it. And so, you know, do I want to be a parent? You know, do I feel like I need a partner? When do I want to be a parent? You know, what kinds of things do I have to have achieved or reached personally before I pursue that? What's valuable to me? I actually think right now we're at a point where so many folks are really considering parenthood much more seriously in the sense that they're not just automatically assuming they'll do it. But they're thinking about the state of the world. They're thinking about climate change. They're thinking about things that make them kind of pause a bit. And I think that's great, actually. I mean, I don't love the reasons for why people have to pause. But I love that people are really asking themselves, well, why do I want to be a parent? Is this an important part of my journey in this lifetime?
One thing that really stood out to me in your chapter about deciding to become a parent is when people are thinking about that question, you suggest that LGBTQ folks are usually more likely to spend more time on this question, in part just because of being a new visible type of family system. So talk a little bit about that. Why there's probably been more deliberation for queer couples than for heteronormative couples.
Right. I mean, I think a big piece is parenthood has not been expected. It's not seen as a normative life goal or transition, which of course is evidence of heteronormativity, the idea that, right, that's just something that straight married people do. So in a way that encourages that deliberation, that consciousness. But of course, there's also just so many more practical barriers. You know, will my family support me? Will I be able to be a parent, especially right now? You know, if I want to adopt, can I find an agency that will work with us? If I want to pursue biological means of parenthood, what are the implications, for example, of the Dobbs decision for my access to in vitro fertilization? Mm-hmm. So just thinking through the many, many hurdles that folks have to go through, inevitably, it's going to be a much more deliberate kind of ponderous process.
Yeah, it's much more rare to have like an accidental pregnancy or something for
right.
queer couples.
I mean, it does
right?
happen yeah. because there are so many bisexual folks, for example, and queer folks and people who have sex with people with, you know, different reproductive organs, that it absolutely can happen. And in fact, there's some data showing that, you know, among young people, among teens, that queer and trans people are actually at a higher risk of unintended pregnancy because they don't experience or receive appropriate STI prevention that is geared towards their specific circumstances. It's all very heteronormative, or they think they can't get pregnant, right? So that aside, I mean, there are unintended pregnancies, but it's not typical for kind of your, you know, the situation we're thinking about, which is like maybe a same-sex couple.
Right. One of the most moving parts, I don't remember who the person was, but I think you're quoting someone who had just grown up thinking that it wasn't a possibility for them. And I think it was a gay man who was saying he wanted to have a family, but it just wasn't on the radar. And so it was kind of something he had emotionally relinquished with grief, and then realized the possibilities, and then was able to really think about it again. And what a gift that was to someone like that.
Yeah, it can be a real roller coaster, because for, you know, many of the men that I did talk to, especially those who grew up at a certain time, they kind of buried their desire, right? There was kind of a grieving process. This isn't going to happen for me. I came out, you know, everyone kind of grieved for me. My parents were like, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, we love you, maybe, but we're really sad you're not going to be a parent.
Right.
And then it was only when they reached adulthood and realized that this was an option that they kind of reimagined, right, this possibility for themselves.
You interviewed a lot of people for this book as part of a broad survey, right? Mm-hmm. And what kind of reasons did you hear from people about why they wanted to have children?
I think, you know, many of the reasons would be exactly what you would find from cis straight people, right? A love of children, wanting to kind of shape and have an influence on a young person, wanting to have some sort of legacy and kind of live on, even an adopted child that wasn't necessarily through bloodlines or anything, but impacting another human being and having your influence live on, kind of teaching moral character. You know, some people joked, but I don't think it was entirely joking that they wanted somebody to take care of them when they got older. But much of it, you know, especially because so many LGBT folks adopt, a lot of it really does come from altruism. Mm. You know, we have a certain amount of resources. We've reached a certain level of stability in our lives. We want to give back. We don't want it to just be about us. And we would like to give a home and give a family and provide for somebody who otherwise wouldn't have a family.
You also talk about how sometimes a gay couple has different levels of desire, right? So one partner might be really driven to have children. The other might be more ambivalent or even kind of opposed to it. There's a great thought exercise that you suggest in the book. And I really liked this a lot. I think this could work for a lot of different people. You say, live in the yes for a week. Imagine you've decided to become a parent. And then live in the no for a week. Imagine you've decided not to. And write down all of your thoughts and feelings and questions. Write in a journal. You suggest using different colors when you're feeling more excited or when you're feeling more ambivalent or maybe even scared. And then after living in the yes and the no, to then evaluate that with your partner. How did you come up with that? That is such a great idea.
I think I drew actually from a bunch of different resources. And also, I've been kind of leading different workshops for many years. And sometimes things come from just, I sometimes think my greatest ideas just literally come on the spot. You know, like I'll be working with some parents or prospective parents and I'll say, okay, this isn't working. Like, try this, you know, or, you know, go home and try this. But I do think that that particular exercise came from a couple different sources and then sort of, you know, with my particular spin on it, right? Which is usually to really be thinking about the idea that there's really no right answer, right? That the idea that you shouldn't, like maybe you're not going to be a parent, right? Or maybe you're going to become a parent alone. Maybe your partner is ultimately going to say, I'm not doing this, right? So it's looking at the reality head on and not necessarily making an assumption about what's going to happen. And for some folks, they complete this exercise with their partner and they realize, wow, one of us is not so on board and one of us is. Mm-hmm. And then that there is a reckoning there where we either do this and we kind of do it not knowing really what will happen, or we are going to go our separate ways, or we're not going to do it, right? This relationship is the most important thing to me and I don't want to start this parenthood journey without a completely committed partner.
So many people are faced with these kind of crossroads and it's a great opportunity for regrets, but but it's also just, I mean, this is life. And the fact that your book is guiding people and helping to coach people through these questions, it's extremely valuable. What kind of barriers do LGBTQ folks talk about that get in the way of becoming parents? What are some of the responses you got to that?
So, I mean, there are the kind of internal barriers, right? Which, you know, are the things that I can't be a good parent, I won't be a good parent because I'm gay, or, you know, all this kind of internalized homophobia or transphobia, the things that we're getting from society saying you shouldn't be a parent or your kids will be,
or like you'll harm kids. Yeah,
you will harm kids. Or sometimes, you know, most of them say, I don't think I will harm kids, right? They haven't fully internalized that, but they think my kid will be teased, my kid will feel bullied, like an outsider, my kid will be bullied. And they may actually be hearing that from their own families. So families will say, you know, I'm sure you would be a great parent, but it's other people I'm worried about. I'm worried about other people treating you badly. You know, your neighbor's not accepting you. Your kid's peer is not accepting them. Other parents being cruel to you. So it's certainly that, but it's all that, right? It's all the external stuff. It's the, you know, the fact that in many states, you know, it's really hard. There are many agencies that are either explicitly or implicitly biased against LGBTQ foster carers or adopters. And many of the folks that I talk to face many barriers where even if they can find an agency that's willing to work with them, maybe they don't get any calls for prospective children or birth family members don't choose them to be the adoptive parents in open adoptions. So the stigmas sort of have many, many different tentacles of potential influence. So there's all those kind of structural barriers. For many folks, too, they don't really consider it until they're maybe older. And so that curtails their options a little bit more. And so, you know, if they're in their 40s, for example, then they're thinking, well, my reproductive options are more limited. Now I'm turning to adoption. Now I may be faced bias based on age, as well as sexual orientation, as well as gender for many gay men, because many people think men can't be as good of parents as women. So there's all those gender related barriers as well. And then, of course, for a lot of folks, right, like not all LGBT people have access to financial resources and they don't necessarily have supportive families. So if you have limited income, you don't have family support, those can be significant barriers as well.
Let's spend a second, too, on we've both mentioned this, the claim that children in LGBTQ families are at a disadvantage compared to children who are in other families. This was a big talking point amongst people who were opposed to marriage equality, for example, that this would be bad for the children. What does the data show about that? There's been research about this. What do we learn from that actual research?
Yeah, so we know from decades of research on kids with LGBT parents who were not married, and then we have some data from kids whose parents were married, that concerns about the well-being of children are unfounded, that children do fine. They show similar social, emotional, developmental outcomes. There's some places where they even arguably outperform kids who are raised in cisgender heterosexual parent families. It's not entirely clear why. So, for example, they may do better in certain areas because they are born or adopted to parents who have more resources, right? Because the folks who become parents are a little bit more rarefied. They're a little bit more select because they have had to get through so many things to become a parent. They may have more resources. So that could be helping to explain that. It could also be that the challenges that their parents have had to face have built a certain resilience that those parents then pass on to their children. It could be that they work harder, say, in school, or, you know, have greater access to, say, therapy because of their parents' alertness to the ways that their families might be perceived. So there's so many different reasons why, but they don't seem to show negative outcomes. They're not mad that they have gay parents. The only sort of challenges that they really experience systematically comes from outside. It comes from external judgment. And so right now what we're seeing, so I'm doing a lot of work in Florida looking at how that legislation around the Parental Rights and Education Act is affecting LGBT families. Those families, they are stressed. They are stressed by the fact that they now face pressure, for example, not to talk about their families in school or feel that they can't be as open about their families. But that's coming from outside. And the limited work that we have looking at kids in married families or what happens to kids when their LGBT parents get married shows really positive outcomes. So for kids, having one parent whose legal status might be tenuous or unclear, that was stressful too. Having a biological say and a non-biological mom and only being connected to your biological mom, that's very stressful for families. So having, you know, some more greater legal protections is incredibly beneficial to children.
Speaking personally, what would it have meant for you to just see other families like yours when you were young? Because you talked about stressors and the sort of, you know, it's connected to visibility, I think. So personally, what would it have meant to you to see more visibility growing up?
Oh, it would have been huge. I mean, at the time, there were absolutely no, I don't think there was a single poster family of LGBT, you know, families. That happened much more in the 90s when, you know, like Rosie O'Donnell and other queer parents sort of became more visible. But really, there was nothing. So, I mean, for me, it would have just been a light bulb, even just to see one and to know that this was something that was real and this was happening. It was just something that wasn't being talked about. But, you know, secrecy and isolation breeds shame. And for kids, for example, right now living in states where they're being told they shouldn't talk about their families, that could really turn inward to feel something is wrong with me. Something is wrong with my family. The invalidation that those families are facing is heartbreaking to me because it doesn't have to be this way. Everyone's families can be recognized as valid. We don't have to demonize certain kinds of families.
Yeah, there seems kind of a bad faith effort on the part of people who are already discriminating against LGBTQ families to then try to say, oh, these outcomes are bad. Look, these kids are being hurt when societal pressures and discrimination themselves are harming people, right? Mm-hmm. And it also, any kind of negativity or any kind of bad things that happen in an LGBTQ family can then be used as a referendum on the idea of marriage equality instead of saying, oh, here are some of the difficulties that these particular families face. What can we do as a society? What can we do as therapists? What can we, you know, whatever to help these families? Instead, they're really talking about those things as a way to disqualify LGBTQ families rather than address how to improve situations for LGBTQ folks, right?
100%. And I really don't ever want to assume that LGBT people are somehow like immune from stress, right? We don't want to say that. So actually hard things do happen in these families. These families also, like straight cisgender families, experience challenges with mental illness and substance use and family struggles and dysfunction. Like all families struggle with those issues, you know, children with behavior problems, physical illness and death, right? All of these things happen. So it's not fair to take any family and look at something that's happening within it and blame that family structure for that thing, especially when we're denying them access to resources. If we see, for example, that queer parents in Florida suddenly report higher levels of depression, it would not really be fair or make sense to blame them for those high levels of depression and how it might be impacting their job performance or their parenting. It would make a lot more sense to think about the laws and the policies that are creating the circumstances where they are becoming so stressed that they are becoming depressed.
How do you recommend LGBTQ folks deal with any internalized stigma that they're growing up with, that sense of shame or the questions they have about whether they would be fit parents because of stereotypes or things that they've heard? What are some ideas for people as they're dealing with their own internalized stigma in deciding to become a parent?
Yeah, I think that community support, so having access to other queer people and parents who have reached some level of security in themselves and who are confident and competent around parenthood, I think can be really powerful and empowering to kind of see role models and to begin to kind of take those lessons on oneself. I think, you know, access to LGBT competent therapists can really be helpful in processing those feelings of inadequacy, doubt, self-doubt, doing a lot of that personal work, and really being able to eventually situate those beliefs where they belong, which is they're coming from out here and they really don't have much to do with us in here. Could be society, but it could also be just, you know, your parents or your religion or your extended family.
That's helpful. So people can check out more in that chapter. Let's move to adoption here. Your second chapter talks all about adoption. And you say that LGBTQ folks are somewhere between 4 and 10 times more likely to adopt than heterosexual couples. And, you know, and you've already touched on some reasons why that is. Let's talk instead directly about what kind of questions you suggest LGBTQ families think about when they're thinking about adoption as their option for expanding their families. What should they be thinking about together?
So I think certainly it's really important to think about the really basic question of how important it is to be biologically related to a child that you are raising. For some folks, that is not an issue. They imagine parenthood not connected to having a child that looks like them or that will carry on certain characteristics. I think some amount of flexibility, cognitive flexibility, emotional flexibility is really important with adoption because, hey, any of us who are parents know, you just don't know what you're going to get, right? Like your kid could just be so different from you. You're going to have so many things that you just never expected you'd be dealing with. But when a kid is adopted, that's kind of to the nth power, right? So just because you really love to read and you love to do puzzles and you went to college and you got your PhD, good for you. But your kid may have no interest in any of those things. And they're not going to share, say, your whatever, your sense of humor, your attention span, like who knows? So to be open is, I think, really, really important. And then you start to winnow down into the other kinds of decisions around how important it is to have a child that, you know, is racially similar to me. How would that be for my extended family? What kinds of things am I open to in terms of, you know, prenatal drug exposure or an older child or a sibling group? Where do my values and my sense of my own abilities and limitations, where do those fall? Because having a sense of your own limitations is a really important thing as a parent in general, but especially when you're thinking about adoption.
You mentioned race. There was a section that talked about some of the anxieties that I think a particular couple kind of talked about with you. Basically, the idea that this person wasn't sure if they were equipped to raise a Black child, for example, in the United States. And it wasn't from a sense of racism in the sense of like, oh, I don't like Black children or whatever, but rather, am I equipped to raise a child? I'm white. I don't have that background. It would be in a white circumstance. One of our episodes is on transracial adoption. So this comes up. So maybe talk a little bit about how LGBTQ folks might wrestle with that idea of race. Because there's this weird like, oh, I don't want to seem racist if I'm saying, oh, I don't want to adopt children who aren't white or who aren't my same race. But at the same time, there are real reasons why that can be a concern. Transracial adoption can be really difficult.
Yeah, I think you need to be thinking about, you know, it's not fair to adopt a child of a different race than you are if you are not really up for it and comfortable with it, period. That being said, most kids are not just sort of in these little boxes. First of all, there's a lot of multiracial kids, right? And we don't want to encourage a practice where people say, well, I will be open to adopting transracially if, you know, they're mostly white, right? Like that leads us down some pretty not great paths. But I think in terms of race, you know, you need to be thinking of beyond yourself. You need to be thinking about your community, your school, your family, there are plenty of families that say, well, I'm open to, as a, for example, a white person adopting a child of color, but then they bring this child into their world and they live in a white community. Their children would be, you know, attending a predominantly white school. Their extended family is white. So it's important that parents do that work to think, is this even really fair, before they go down that road? Because a child who, say, is Black and is living in a white town, white school, that's not great for that child. And it's not fair as a parent to kind of immerse that child in that world. You may need to decide, I'm going to move, or, you know, so I can have access to these resources. And I talked to many parents who did make choices about, you know, I have whole area of research about how parents choose schools for their kids. And many parents will say, well, there's this school, which is mostly white, and it's a really good school. And then there's this school, which maybe has sort of less of a great academic reputation, but my kid will be surrounded by people who look like them. And that's more important.
Yeah, it's a really helpful chapter. It talks all about different adoption options, public and private, international adoption, a lot of different things. So people that are considering adoption, this is a great primer for that. What strengths would you say LGBTQ folks bring to the table when it comes to adoption? Are there any unique strengths that you found as you were doing your research?
Yeah, many folks will actually tell you something that they feel, which I do think is a strength, which is that, you know, they have a history of being discriminated against or being judged or people, you know, making assumptions about them based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. And so that in turn makes them more open actually to adopting a child of a different race or with a variety of different potential differences, that they sort of feel like, you know, as somebody who's faced stigma in the world or as somebody who has faced challenges, I feel like I can be a more sensitive parent because of that. So it makes me more open both to adopting children, but it also makes me more open to kind of dealing with whatever issues that the child kind of comes along with. So the challenges that they feel that they've faced in their life have actually made them better parents.
Your book also talks about donor insemination and also surrogacy. These are more ways that LGBTQ families are formed. What kind of advice do you offer for people that are thinking about donor insemination when they're thinking about having children?
Yeah, we're really moving towards a place where both in the adoption world and reproductive technologies, we understand that kids will want information about their origins, regardless of how their families are formed. So there's a movement towards, if you're going to pursue donor insemination, for example, we, you know, people want to access donors where there's an option of them becoming known if they're not known already. For example, the child can contact them or know more about them at the age of 18. So it used to be that we had mostly fully anonymous donors, and now we're realizing that children eventually really want to access that information. Likewise, in the adoption world, we're really moving towards open adoptions where children, you know, have access to their birth families or at least birth family information.
Yeah, this is very child-centered, right? Rather than, because parents might feel protective or want to be like, I just want separation from that. But then they're finding that as kids grow, they don't want that separation. And there's a drive to know more.
And I think many parents would say, before I had a kid, before I adopted a kid or early on, it was very important to me to have those boundaries. We are the parents. Mm-hmm. But then as they're parenting real human beings who have real questions, that becomes less important than helping that child access information. And they realize that all those concerns around boundaries and, you know, who's really the parent, that's actually less important.
Your chapter has a lot of great questions, again, for people that couples can talk about together, like, will we be genetically tied in some way? And who will? And why are we making that decision? And how are we going to feel about that? And also, you talk about trans and non-binary folks and how providers who are helping people transition, especially, you know, younger folks who are transitioning, should be really well informed about options for reproductive technologies to help them. So if someone who's assigned female at birth is transitioning to male, there are ways to preserve eggs, for example, and they're not making a decision to use those eggs. They're just keeping those options open, right? Talk a little bit about that for trans and non-binary folks.
Yeah. So first of all, trans and non-binary folks may not know at when they're teenagers, for example, or young adults, if they even want to be parents. So it really is, as you said, it's a matter of keeping those options open. and finding providers who will help them to make the kinds of decisions that they may not know that they might want later down the road. So really helping to fully inform them of their options, what things are reversible and what things are not reversible. This isn't a barrier to getting the care that they want. You know, absolutely, they should have access to the hormones, for example, that they want, but enable them to make those decisions that will help them have those options. And then for reproductive providers who are working with trans and non-binary folks when they're actively trying to get pregnant, for example, we also need providers to be really knowledgeable about that as well. You know, what are the options? When does somebody need to go off of hormones? How can we support them in getting pregnant? What kinds of things can we do to make the birth experience more pleasant, to make visits more pleasant? How can we refer to body parts, for example, in a way that feels affirming and respectful and not alienating and offensive?
Yeah, chapter 5 is so good on this. You talk about how important it is for LGBTQ families to consider agencies that they're working with to be tuned into where discrimination exists, and sometimes also recognizing that they might have to make trade-offs. They might have a provider that they'll be working with who is filled with, you know, throwing microaggressions around or making them feel uncomfortable, and that there are trade-offs that LGBTQ families end up having to make in navigating the medical system and the adoption system and fertility system as well. Maybe spend a little bit of time on what kind of problems were waiting in the wings once marriage equality became the law of the land, for example. Now, couples could be legally married, and now they want access to these different services. What kind of issues are people still confronting, even though we're years past the legalization of marriage equality?
I could go in so many different directions. I mean, in terms of trade-offs, people have to make trade-offs when they're building their families, when they're thinking about agencies or where to give birth, where to put their children in daycare or school or where they live. It's all a matter of balancing, right? It's, well, you know, I'm a Black child who also has two dads, right? And, you know, we live in a rural area, right? Like, what am I going to do to kind of create the best environment for my child? I probably won't send them to the top academic school that is very racially diverse and has lots of two-mom families, right? So what's most important for my child? What's going to help them to develop into a confident person, right? Mm-hmm. So there's constantly that trade-off, right? And likewise, if you're pursuing a birth, you know, you're trying to figure out where to give birth as a trans person, you're balancing finances and geography and comfort, maybe a medical condition, maybe you're an older parent giving birth, so you're also thinking about that, right? Mm-hmm. It's a constant place of trade-off. I mean, I think right now we're at a place where there's the explicit barriers that people face, and then the more kind of subtle or implicit barriers. So you may go to a hospital, for example, or a school that says, oh, we're LGBT friendly, or we have other two mom families here. But what that looks like in practice can really, really vary. Likewise, you may be living in a really red state that seems to have very little access to LGBT friendly providers, but you know, you find a place and the people are actually quite wonderful and lovely, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you just don't know. And there's a lot of variability. And sometimes, you know, it's really about finding the right people or the right person within, say, a given agency who will be an advocate, who maybe has a personal connection, you know, maybe has an LGBT child themselves, who will be kind of a warrior for you. And even in those places in the country where it can be really hard to access formal supports.
Right. I like how you talked about the networking that LGBTQ families engage in as well. The internet makes it even more easier than ever to network with people, to get advice, suggestions, to read reviews about different places and experiences that people have. So in some ways, despite ongoing discrimination, I think we're also at a time when people can feel more empowered because we can talk to each other and connect with each other and get ideas from each other too. So barriers, but also I think opportunities to navigate those because we can communicate more easily.
Yeah, one of the suggestions I always tell, I do a lot of workshops with schools who are trying to become more LGBT affirming, as I said, you know, just offer names and contact information to LGBT perspective parents so that they can contact other folks who have had students at your school. Because that's the kind of in-person version of the Yelp review. They can talk to another human being and ask questions, and they can network. It also shows that you're confident enough to be able to share that information, which is a good thing.
Right. Yeah, it's your own personal Yelp. That's great. Let's talk about surrogacy for a second. You say this is an option that's mostly chosen by gay, bi, or queer men in particular. So what are some of the things that people consider when it comes to surrogacy? So having someone carry the child for a couple.
Yeah, the biggest, for folks who are pursuing surrogacy, I just always have to start by saying that it's, you know, about $150,000 or $200,000. So it's really an option for a very small segment of the population, unless you do overseas surrogacy, which has its own real ethical issues, which is it's less expensive, but you're going to another country and paying a woman to carry your child.
And there may be safety issues, and maybe your book kind of goes into these. There's
absolutely, and travel
inequality. Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot that goes on there, and a lot of uncertainty in terms of that process. But in terms of things to consider, I mean, I think for folks who do pursue surrogacy, who go down that road, there's a lot of uncertainty there too. So it may seem like the most obviously certain outcome versus adoption, where everything seems very unclear. But surrogates do not always get pregnant right away. They may conceive, they may have a miscarriage. I mean, they're a human being, right? So just as many sort of unexpected issues can come up there. Some folks really, really bond with their surrogates, and some folks, there may not be that same relationship. So it is a relationship like all others. There's also so many people and institutions involved in surrogacy. There's so much legal interaction that it is it's a very complicated process. It's not even legal in some states, so.
Right. They're legal issues. So people that want to pursue it, again, your book does a fantastic job in a short chapter laying out a lot of questions, not just about practical things, but about emotional things. Genetic asymmetry is a term that you bring up that I hadn't really thought of, but we've touched on this a little bit, but the idea that if one partner is genetically related to a child and the other one isn't, that could cause complicated feelings that people might not have anticipated before they actually have a child.
Yeah. So in many cases, if it's, either surrogacy or conceiving through donor insemination, there is usually one partner who's biologically related and one partner who is not. And so, that's significant to the outside world in that we place a lot of emphasis on biology and to the primacy of biological bonds, which can lead that non-biological parent to either be perceived or to feel like less of a parent. I'm sort of the belief that we shouldn't pretend that those things don't exist, that there are many ways to, say, bond with a child and have a great relationship with the child, but we shouldn't say, it doesn't matter, because I think that's disingenuous. I do know of surrogacy families where they do not tell their child who the parent is that is biologically related to them, which dad, for example, is biologically related. And I have questions about that, because to say that it's not important kind of almost reifies how important it is. If we're not going to tell you, it's clearly so important. And as somebody who doesn't really like family secrets, I think it's more important to say he's the biological parent or he's the biological parent and we're a family, right? And here's all the reasons why we're both equally your dads.
So many things for people to consider. Again, a lot of the questions in the book will help people think through things that they might not anticipate if they haven't talked to people about this or spent a lot of time thinking about it. That's Abby Goldberg, a clinical psychologist and professor. We're talking about the book LGBTQ Family Building, A Guide for Prospective Parents. All right, there's a chapter on the transition to parenthood. So you talk about the ways people can become parents, but then you talk about how becoming a parent's a huge transition for anybody. And the book's helpful because it talks about the kind of general life changes that people can expect, but also what LGBTQ people in particular might face. You pay special attention to mental health, for example. And there's a stat here that really surprised me in this chapter. You say that there are some studies that suggest that most parents, 72% of parents, said that their life satisfaction increased during the first year of parenting. That's a really challenging year, and that's a really high number. So I'm interested in what you make of that this life satisfaction increase.
Yeah, I think it points out the importance of looking at different dimensions of change, because most people just looked at kind of like they just look at stress and they look at kind of mental health. And you do see those things, like you do see stress increase and you do see mental health decrease.
Yeah.
But what we have to always think of is like joy and life satisfaction are other components of life. Like you can have a really stressful job, for example, but have a lot of joy associated with your job, a lot of satisfaction associated with your job. And some people, that's valuable. It's more valuable than having an easy job where there's very little stress, but very little satisfaction. So I think it makes sense because most people will say parenthood transformed me. It transformed my life. It's changed who I am. And I'm a lot sleepier. And me and my relationship, you know, our relationship is a little bit more tense. We don't have as much time together. So really understanding that parenthood causes changes in multiple domains. The ideal, of course, is that mental health will eventually recover. And often it does. So we have to also know that, that some of those negative changes, they're really temporary. They're not always temporary, but they're often temporary.
And you lay out some of the stressors that happen. I mean, there's the obvious stuff that happens to every kind of parent, lack of sleep, redistribution of kind of household work, which can be interesting, whether LGBT couples take on traditionally feminine or traditionally masculine, like provider slash nurturer, or whether couples find ways to create their own family dynamics. What are some tips, some practices, some advice you would give to people to navigate those early parenting years? I know it's hard to rank that kind of stuff, but does something immediately come to mind that's like, this is a crucial thing for couples to do?
Yeah, I think two things. One is that relationship is important. I mean, if you want to stay, presumably if you are in a member of a couple, you know, and you want to stay together. So many of my participants, so many couples that I've interviewed have said, we put our relationship on the back burner. And you can only really do that for so long. So, you know, in an ideal world, you will have access to some time alone where you can honestly just laugh or enjoy each other's company without the really kind of constant challenge of caring for another being's needs. And so, you know, whether that means taking time at the end of the day just to talk and sit outside and catch up or going out, you know, whatever, but making sure that relationship remains a priority. I think some flexibility and sort of awareness that what things are now won't always be this way and being flexible to change things up. So especially around the division of chores, for example, reevaluating, you know, how that kind of is going. I've done so much work on the division of tasks and how couples divide up chores. And one thing that seems really important is that a lot of times, like nobody really likes most tasks. So it's really about who hates it the least. That's how I think about it. It's like, who hates cleaning the litter box the least, or who hates unloading the dishwasher the least? And so checking in about whether that's continuing to be a satisfactory and fair division of labor. Because when things feel unfair and when people feel unappreciated, that's when the problems start. So if I feel like I'm doing 70% and I don't even feel like my partner appreciates me, I'm much madder than if I'm doing 70% and I feel like we're constantly acknowledging that I'm doing 70% because I may be working less, for example, and how things need to change, but this is the way it is right now.
Yeah, you say that like overall studies show that same gender couples tend to share paid and unpaid labor more equally on average than heterosexual couples.
Yeah.
Perhaps because they already have higher expectations for equality, or perhaps because they don't easily slot into your 1950s Leave It to Beaver view of how mom and dad should be. But also you say there are some couples who do kind of fall into these more traditional patterns where, let's say there's a gay couple who the one partner has a more high paying job, they're gone more often, and then the other partner, she's at home doing more of the quote domestic stuff, the unpaid stuff. And that those circumstances, that doesn't mean that one of them is necessarily more or less happy. You say that differences in contributions don't necessarily lead to tension or conflict. It really depends on the particular relationship and how the couples actually feel about this stuff. Because some couples are like, hey, they might feel okay with a division like that, and that works for them. So it's not like, oh, everyone needs to fit this vision of marital equality. It's more about making sure that people are informed and feeling like they're treated fairly, and that is kind of what people should pay attention to.
Yeah, it's really about the match between values and expectations and what the actual division of labor is. Yeah.
The next chapter, the last chapter, talks about the early years. We'll just talk about this briefly here. You encourage people to establish their family story really early with their children, to have a story of how their family came to be, what it is, especially because they're still living in a heteronormative society where a lot of people around them, a lot of peer children might be casting judgment or even just making comments like kids do, like, why don't you have a mommy? Or like, why do you have two dads? And so you say that communication with kids young is really important. Some people might think, oh, I just want them to stay innocent and not even think about stuff until they get older, rather than establishing a family story early. Why do you think that might not be the best approach for people?
Well, I think you can establish the family story early and do it in a developmentally appropriate and kind of age progressed way. If you don't tell them anything or you avoid those questions, you're not being truthful. And so I think that, you know, giving them a simpler story that they can sort of internalize and then maybe share with others, even if it doesn't have all the details, right? So it may not be perfectly truthful, right, for what they share with others, right? So
every parent does this.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, you know, there's a lot of things that parents are explaining to their kids. They're not going to give them the whole story because they're going to tell, you know, their friends or whomever. But, you know, they're going to give them enough information that they need. You know, I have two moms. We got help from somebody else to make our family. Okay, that's what you got.
You also give some really great advice on gender expansive parenting practices, like using they pronouns for people that people don't know. So kind of normalizing they pronouns so that things aren't so binary, essentialized, actively challenging gender stereotypes. So if someone says, oh, boys can't have long hair, to say, oh, I actually think they can, or to like talk to your kids about those. Reading books that show diversity is really important. And modeling some nonconformity and being conscious about that with kids. So this chapter has a lot of practical advice on dealing with kids in their early years. And that's kind of where the book cuts off then. And it takes people through the process of deciding to become parents, the methods they can use to become parents, and then those early parenting years. And it seems to me that your overall hope in the book is just that people will have choices, understand what the choices are, and be empowered to make those choices. That seems to be the driving purpose of your book.
Yeah, and absolutely. And for folks who can pick it up, they could pick it up at an earlier stage in their life, you know, maybe when they're not even thinking about parenthood, but are interested to know what the different pathways might look like in the future, or folks who are really at kind of a crossroads and trying to figure out what they're going to be doing, as well as people who are already parents and maybe are thinking through, you know, maybe their next transition to parenthood, or maybe they would like some guidance around, you know, supporting the other people in their life around these decisions.
Yeah, I can honestly say I found the book to be helpful. And again, I come from my family, my partner, my two kids. Mm-hmm. There are questions that we probably should have asked before we had our second kid or before we had our first child. But it's not too late to even address that, though, to think through those things together. So even though we've passed some of the chapters up, it still, for me, has been helpful to go back and look at some of these questions and to see how LGBT families are navigating them and kind of what the differences are and the unique strengths. So I think this is a book with broad applicability, and we need more books like this. So many of the parenting books are very heteronormative, which I think limits their strength. So I just want to say congrats on this book before we close with the Choose Your Own Adventure segment.
Oh, thank you.
Of the interview. Yeah, so we're going to talk regrets, challenges, and surprises. You can speak to one, two, or all three of these. Is there something you would change about the book now that it's published, about something that was really challenging in the process of writing it, or something that surprised you that sticks in your mind is, wow, I didn't expect that as you were researching the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'll speak to two. So in terms of change, it's not that I would change it. It's just that so much has happened since I wrote the book that, you know, we're in such a different state, you know, with respect to this country that, you know, I think that I probably would give more time to, if you're living in a particularly challenging geographic area or state with respect to figuring out how you're going to become a parent, you know, what are the things to think through in terms of relocation or working with providers across state lines and the kinds of challenges that might come up there. Because some of the challenges that I talk about are intensified for certain folks. I think in terms of a surprise, it's hard to overemphasize how much money matters.
Mm-hmm.
So just how much your access to financial resources impacts everything from where you live, what options are available to you, even as you start the family building journey. Can you pursue private adoption? Can you pursue infertility treatments? Or are you working with the child welfare system just by default? What kinds of access to, therapies can you have if your child is having challenges? Can you think about private school if you're living in a state where, you don't really want to send your child to public school because of what they might be exposed to in terms of ideas about their family? So just in terms of the access to resources, it really shapes so much of what people have available to them.
But your work continues, Abby. What are you up to now, now that the book's done? And, you said you do workshops, you're doing a lot of things. What else have you got going on?
So one of the things I'm doing is I'm doing a lot of work looking at how the Parental Rights and Education Act, or the Don't Say Gay Act, has affected families in Florida, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing some research there. I'm also going to be writing a human sexuality textbook, which really centers LGBT folks as opposed to kind of them being off in the periphery. There's so many human sexuality texts that really don't give enough kind of attention and foregrounding to how those experiences play out. And I'm continuing to do, different talks and workshops for folks, different audiences. I'm going to, a lot of lawyers and the legal realm is very interesting to me, serving as an expert witness in trials that, where custody, for example, on same-sex couples is an issue.
That's Abby Goldberg, clinical psychologist and professor, author of the book LGBTQ Family Building, A Guide for Prospective Parents. She's also been featured in places like the New York Times, The Atlantic, USA Today, and more. And she's director of women's and gender studies at Clark University. You can check out familyproclamations.org for more information. We'll have some links to some of Abby's work and to the book, obviously. Abby, thanks so much for spending this time with us to talk about this great book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Camille Messick for being a wonderful transcript editor. You can check transcripts of every episode on the website, familyproclamations.org. I'm also grateful to longtime supporter David Osler, who sponsored the first group of transcripts. And I'm always looking for transcript sponsors, so if you got a little extra change rolling around in your purse, let me know. The email address is blair@firesidepod.org. You can also send me feedback about any episode at the same email address. There's much more to come on Family Proclamations. If you're enjoying the show, tell a friend. Get some podcast chatter going at your next family reunion. You could also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Check out this review from Mountain Bluebird. Blair always finds the most fascinating variety of guests and does a stellar job guiding a conversation. I learn a lot every time I listen. Well, thanks for that review. I learn a lot every time I do an interview. Thanks to Mates of State for providing our theme song. Family Proclamations is part of the Dialogue Podcast Network. I'm Blair Hodges, and I'll see you next time.